Hi, everybody. I'm an alcoholic, and my name's Tom. And it's wonderful to be here tonight. You know, there's probably some other places I could be on a Monday night, and probably some other stuff I could be doing, but there's probably no better place I could be, and probably nothing better that I could be doing. I love AA. It didn't just save my life. It changed it into one worth living. And I'm just a truly grateful alcoholic. And I want to thank James and Rachel and the group Conscience for having me here tonight. It's always just an honor and a blessing to be able to do service in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I'm really happy about that. The fine print. I'm an alcoholic. My name is Tom Roach, and my sobriety date is June 26th of 2001. I'm kind of I'm nervous. I'm nervous up here tonight. And it's not like I haven't talked before. I've actually spoke before. But I get nervous when I speak, and I always thought I would outgrow that, you know. And I get to do this a lot, and that's truly a blessing. And I still get nervous about it, especially when it's someplace that I haven't been before. And it used to bother me. I used to think I was going to get over it, and I haven't gotten over it. And now I'm thinking I don't know if I'll ever get over it, and it's okay. And that's just the way that is. you know, I look out here, and I see a number of young people, maybe some people that are new in recovery, and you're looking up here and saying, you know, what the hell is this old guy going to say? If I'm too loud or too soft or whatever, just let me know, because I can't help. Okay, perfect. My life is perfect. I called my sponsor, and I said, how you doing? He says, my life is perfect. He's been sober, you know, whatever, 20-something years more than I have. And so I said, well, if your life is perfect, then I guess mine's almost perfect. And it is almost perfect. What the hell was I just talking about? What was I saying?
Life being perfect.
I am right before that. I'm going to need help tonight. This is going to be like a participatory thing. Has anybody ever tried this? How long does this take to work? Like halfway through, hopefully, right? Like, I mean, pretty soon, right? How sad is that? You know, I talk a lot, and I'm still using props. I mean, what the hell is... what I was going to say. What? Oh, thank you. Thank you, Natty. Somebody who has heard me before. And so I look out and I see a lot of young people in this meeting. You know, it's funny, remind me again. You know, it's like, I've only got like, you know, two cells left up here, and the synapses don't always fire at the same time. And when they do, they're usually waving goodbye. You know, it's funny, I do this so often in the history and the truth, you know, all this different stuff. I think of it up here as like controlled data situation. You know, corporation, like I'm going to walk into this office room and open up this file cabinet and go to the third step and talk about that. No, I'm going to go to the 10th tradition, no outside controversy. Yeah, but it's not like that at all. It's like waste management up here. You know, it's like a landfill just moving around, and when my mouth is open, whatever's in the front of it kind of falls out. So you're just going to have to bear with me. But I'm lucky tonight because I asked James what to speak about. When I was first asked to speak early on, I used to just go tell my story, but today I know that actually what that means is ask the person who asked you to speak what they'd like you to speak about, because you never know. I mean, here I am tonight speaking, and tomorrow night I'll be down. I'm blessed to be doing the steps at the 12-step house right now, but it's only a half a blessing because I'm like following Peter. You know, the same thing happened last summer in Del Rey, you know. Like, it's always a blessing to be doing the steps, but really, do you really want to be following Peter or Garrett? You know, I mean, it's like, you know, we're so blessed down here with that. And then Wednesday night I'll be up with Shelley at Central House. We'll be doing a special event on the history of AA, and, you know, he's got the personal angle, you know, knowing Bill and Lois and being in New York with them. And I'm going to be doing the, you know, kind of more the general history of AA. For some of you, maybe have been to the Joe and Charlie Big Book Seminar. Well, it used to be Joe and Charlie. It's still the Big Book Seminar. It still goes on every year. But for the last few years, I've been asked to do the history of AA there. So that's been a blessing, too. So I'll be doing that on Wednesday night, and then on Friday night I'll be speaking about the central fact. So it's, each night it's about something different. The nice thing about tonight is James, when I asked him what would you like me to talk about, he said you can talk about whatever you want. That's like a dangerous thing, you know, for a guy like me. Having done this many times, you know, one of the things that I've, and that's what I'm going to do. I have no idea where I'm going. I'm just kind of going to talk about a bunch of different stuff since I'm not on assignment, as it were, to talk about something specifically, which often I am, talking about doing a step series, or I'm doing a tradition series, or I'm doing the history of AA, or whatever that is. And so I am going to be a little all over tonight, I guess, but that's okay. And, well, it's okay for me. And but the talking thing is a funny thing. I'll get back to that in a second. Thanks, Maddie. You know, as I started to say a minute ago, 5 minutes ago, you know, I look out and, you know, there's a lot of young people here and a lot of newcomers, and you may be looking up here and saying, what the hell is this old guy going to say that I'm going to be able to identify with, and blah, blah, blah. And just so you know, I know all about the face space and the flitter. Yeah, I am so down with that. I feel you. And it turns out that you guys actually know a lot about what's going on in here, because this really turns out to be all about making OMG my BFF. Right? That's what this whole deal is about, right? And which reminds me, before I get too distracted, that, you know, if you've been to a step series or a big book study with me, my favorite part of the meeting is always the lighter side. And so if you've been through step two with me, you've probably heard this before, or the big book in We Agnostics. And so I'm going to read it, because otherwise I'm going to forget to do it in a couple minutes. And it's my favorite, well, one of my favorite things. Non-conference approved, but there are a lot of great non-conference approved literature, you know. And 11 steps, what does the 11th step say? Go read some non-conference approved literature. No, really, go, quickly. Read some non-conference approved literature. Talk to some priests and ministers and rabbis and see, be quick to see where they're right. And we read some non-conference approved literature actually at the end of this meeting. Why we were chosen. It's not conference approved literature. It's one of my favorite pieces of quote unquote AA literature. Non-conference approved, in case you don't know where that came from. That's Judge John T. He's a sober alcoholic. That's at the fourth anniversary of the Chicago group, which was started by Earl T. And if you don't know who Earl T is, his story's in the back of your book. It's called He Sold Himself Short. And he starts AA in Chicago, and that's Judge John, an alcoholic. That's just a short citing from the talk that he does on the fourth anniversary of that group. And it's just an awesome talk, and it's an awesome excerpt of that talk. Talk about our brokenness and why we're chosen. You know, the talking thing is a funny thing, and I'm blessed I do get to do this a lot. You know, as I said, this is the first of four talks I'll do this week. And then somebody asked me to speak yesterday, and I said, you know what, I'm doing a lot of talking this week. My voice is going to be, I lose my voice sometimes. So I actually didn't do that talk yesterday. But the thing is, and you know, at the end of this thing, there's going to be, you know, there's going to be three guys, and they're going to walk out. And the guy on the left is going to be like, I really liked what he said. And the guy on the right is going to be like, I really did not like what he said. And the guy in the middle is going to be like, what the hell did he say? What was he talking about? And that's just how it goes. And that's just okay. And I'm okay with that, you know, after doing a lot of this. And, you know, I used to think that, and I can do this because I'm not on assignment tonight. I can talk about whatever I want. Right? And I used to think about, you know, the longer I was sober, the more important the talks would be, as I would learn more about the steps and more about the history and more about the big book and the traditions and all that. And the funny thing is, what I've learned is exactly the opposite, that it's less and less important. And I know that 90% of what I was required to do tonight, my responsibility, as it were, was done when I was standing here at 7:30 and ready to go, you know? And the reason is because if there's, you know, I don't know, how many people are in here tonight? Like 1,000? Like what was, like, let's say there are 100 people. I don't know. Let's say there's 100 people in here tonight. If there's 100 people in here, there's 100 meetings going on right now. And I'll tell you how I know that. This has happened to me dozens of times. And some of you have heard, you know, a lot of times I talk about the third step, 10-step version of this story. Well, another version of it tonight. And that is this. You know, a few years ago, I was doing a talk not too far from here, and I do my talk. It's one of those half-hour talks and then, you know, a little bit of discussion at the end. And then it was an anniversary night, and there was a guy, and he was celebrating a dozen years. And he comes up, and the presenter gives him his medallion, and instead of talking, and he's presented like over there, and instead of talking there, he comes over to the podium, over to where I am, he's sitting down, and he shakes my hand, and he says, "That was awesome. You said so many things I've never heard. That was incredible." You know, whatever, you know, what people say after you talk. And then he says, "But that thing you said about unconditional love, that was just exactly what I needed." And then he went on, and instead of taking his 3 minutes or 4 minutes to tell everybody all the great stuff that he was doing, he talked about how he had gotten exactly what he needed at that meeting because he wasn't practicing unconditional love in his family and with his wife, and he was getting spiritually unfit, and he needed to hear a message about that, and that he was going to change his behavior after he left that meeting and go back to his family with a new attitude. Now the interesting part, and that sounds awesome, but the interesting part about that was that my first thought was, I didn't say anything about unconditional love. You know, if it had been in my first few years of sobriety, in the rooms, I would have said to him, as he was thanking me at the podium and expressing his gratitude, I would have said, "No, I didn't say that." You know, but, you know, in my next few years, what I would have said was, "Yeah, thanks a lot. You know, it's so important to talk about unconditional love. I don't think I ever do a talk when I don't talk about unconditional," and I would have gone, "Oh, blah, 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 blah." You know, but it was a few years after that. This is just a few years ago, so probably like 9, 10 years sober. And what I said was what I usually say today. I just said, "Thank you." And I knew I hadn't said anything about that, but that's what he had heard, and, you know, God bless him, right? A bunch of people come up to me after the meeting, the way that sometimes happens at meetings. And this one guy comes up, and he says, "I'm not looking for a sponsor, but you said a bunch of things tonight that I think I need your help. I could use your help. Could you be a support person for me? You know, I've been sober 13 years, not looking for a sponsor." At that time, he was sober a few years longer than I was. And he said, "Could I have your number? I'm going through some stuff, and I know, based on what you shared, that you could really help me." And I said, "Absolutely." And most times we never hear. Sometimes we hear, sometimes we don't. And this was a few years ago. I'm doing a step series up in West Palm at the time. And I finished my talk up there, and I'm on my way to drive. So I live down here in Boca. I got to drive a ways to go. And I get a call, and it's that guy. And he said, "Hey, you probably don't remember me. There were a lot of people after the meeting when you talked." And I said, no, I remember you." He said, "Yeah, I got a bunch of time, you know, but I talked to you." I said, "I'm not looking for, don't worry, I know you're real busy, but, you know, I said, there were some things going on that I needed to talk to you about." I said, "Yeah, no, I remember all about that. That's great. That's awesome. I've got some time. Just finished a talk. I'm on my way. I'm going to be in the car for a half hour. And he goes, "That's awesome. You said a number of things that really, really hit me. But the one thing that you said that really hit me between the eyes and that I think is going to change my sobriety is that thing you said about unconditional love." Now I've got 25 years of sobriety telling me that the one thing that they heard was unconditional love, and I knew it was the one thing I didn't talk about. You know, I talked for 30, you know, a little over a half hour. I knew that I hadn't talked about that, but I finally get off the phone with him, and I'm like, you know, I need to rethink this. You know, in early sobriety, I didn't do that, but, you know, as you get older in sobriety, you know, one of the things that I've really learned to do is to listen to people, and especially people that have been around, you know, for some time, and especially longer than I have, and I need to pay attention to that. So I started replaying the talk in my head for the rest of the ride home, and I found it. I found what they were talking about, and maybe I'll get back to that later. Somebody remind me to get back to that later. So what I did, I guess what I'll do for a little while is just tell a little bit about my story. And you're actually lucky. Now, I used to always call my sponsor. I just changed sponsors. As a matter of fact, I've had the same sponsor for a dozen years, and I just now changed. And not because my sponsor was falling short. My sponsor's shortcoming is that he's 3,000 miles and 3 hours away, and I need to move into something more local. And actually, more than that, is he's been sober for about 34 years, and I just think that, you know, the realization, it intuitively came to me the other day that I've given him about all the help I have for him. And I just don't think I have anything left for him, And I think I've gotten him as straightened out as I'm going to get him. And so I made a decision. I looked around the rooms and I said, who needs my help? And who's been sober even longer than him? So I found a guy with a few more years than him that could probably use my help. And hopefully we'll see how that goes. And but somebody I can see eyeball to eyeball. And so I needed to do that. But I always used to talk to my sponsor a lot of times before talks, before doing these talks. And as I said, I go from step series to big book study to tradition series to, maybe one, maybe 2 or 4 week history series. All this, I've been pulled into all sides of the triangle. And what a blessing to have a sponsor that pulled me in all those directions to be asked to do service in all those areas. And I would often call him up and say, I'm going to go speak. Do you have some guidance? And he would always say, go read page 95. And page 95 is in chapter 7, Working with Others. And what he's talking about is, at the top there, what it says is, we never talk down to an alcoholic from a moral or spiritual hilltop. We simply lay out the kid's spiritual tools for his inspection and show how they worked with us. And the reason is given to us 2 paragraphs below that. And it says, if he is to find God, the desire must come from within. My sponsor couldn't impose that on me. AA can't impose that on me. That desire has to come from within. And what a blessing that is for all of you guys, because he started on me very early about that, and it's a good thing that he did, about not preaching from a moral or spiritual hilltop. Because having a guy like me in my religion of origin, we used to call something like this an altar, right? And if that hadn't been imbued in me early on about doing that, this talk would have started out completely differently. And the way this talk would have started out would have been something a little more like this. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. So you all owe my first sponsor a vote of thanks, and you can call him up afterwards and thank him that I'm not going to do that to you today. He saved you from that. All right, so let me talk about my story for a minute. I'm a real alcoholic. And what I remember most about my childhood is my father. And just an awesome presence in my life. And I loved him. I just loved him. I can remember being young, 6 and whatnot. And I wanted to be like him in so many. He was a really smart guy and he taught me how to think. My sponsor tells me what goes on up here is for entertainment purposes only. But I'm having fun up here. And he was a really athletic guy. He was into sports. He taught me how to be athletic. But the one thing that he was that I didn't like is he was an alcoholic. I've never said that about anybody in my whole life, with the exception of myself, except for my father. And I lived with that man day in and day out, and he was an alcoholic. And he was an alcoholic who never found these rooms. And if he didn't die as a direct result, certainly as an indirect result of this illness. He died younger than I am today. He died way too young. Untreated alcoholism. Horrible. We have just a horrible illness. And I wanted to be like him in so many ways, but I just didn't want to do that. I'm getting to be a little older. I'm getting into my teens right in the beginning there. And everybody's starting to do the stuff. Everybody's drinking, driving, doing whatever we do, And especially back then. And I wanted to be like him, but I didn't want to be that. I didn't want to be that alcoholic. So I started to cultivate habits other than alcohol. And what I started to do was smoke marijuana. Now, I know that this is an AA meeting. If I had known it was going to be such a damn controversy, I never would have done it. I didn't know then that I was going to wind up here now. That's just how that goes. And I started doing a lot of that. And I remember I went up to school, I went up to college. And I'd be doing that. And I remember I could be at a mixer, like a dance. And some young co-ed, some girl come up to me and say, hey, Tom, I've been able to talk to you and you're a really sensitive guy and I like you and I think you're understanding and I've got something I need to share and I've never talked to anybody about this and, can you listen to me? I'd be like, sure, go ahead. Now I'm whacked and I'm off in my own head and I'm solving problems. I mean big problems. I don't mean I'm working on my English paper or my math test. I mean I'm working on stuff like, who am I, and why am I here, and how should I live my life? I'm working on big stuff. At the end of 15 minutes, she says, well, what do you think? What do you think about that? It took a lot for me to share that. And all I heard was, wah, 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 wah. So I stopped doing it. Not because I get a good idea, because it's a failed experiment. I can't communicate. I can't talk to anybody. It takes me out of touch. And I start doing everything and try everything. You know, it's like, that's a different time zone. Sex, drugs, rock and roll. You know, I do electrics, up, down, sideways, whatever, wherever you want to go. And then I stopped doing all of it. Not because I get a good idea, because it just really, it's not working for me. And it looks like I might lead a kind of a drug-free life, with the exception of alcohol, which is always there because it's so reliable. You know, I don't ever remember walking into a liquor store, coming out with a bottle, cracking the bottle, taking a swig of it, and say, "I can't believe he beat me," and then having to run in and, like, you know, go on with the clerk. You know, that just doesn't happen. You know, all our buddies, you know, Jim B, Johnny, you know, W, you know, Jack D. They're reliable. They just show up. You know, you crack the bottle and you know it's there. You know, you get the bottle, it's sitting next to you, you're warm and fuzzy all over. You know it's going to be good. And, but then somebody introduced me to a little white powder. Yeah. And I thought I had found God. I thought I had found God. And if I hadn't found God, I had certainly found a higher powder. Yeah. And it was working. And it worked. It took me somewhere else. As a matter of fact, if I had known how well it was going to work, I would have done it sooner. And if it still worked, you'd have a different speaker. It just stopped working. I never knew why. Today I know why. It's an insufficient power. The power runs out. That just isn't enough power. I needed a power so strong that it could hijack a mental blank spot. That'll do that for a little while, but it won't do it in the long run. The power runs out, you know. And you know, I remember in the early 90s, I first came into the rooms in 91, you know, 22 years ago. And I went to an IOP. Anybody know what an IOP is? Intensive outpatient. It's like going to class, you know, a couple hours a day. Yeah, it didn't take. It's just, turns out I needed more than that. You know, it took me a year and a half and a couple of rehabs. And I don't want to spend a lot of time talking about the drinking and drugging. That's a rough deal. I'll tell you this. It's not like the drinking. You know, it's not like friends weren't telling me that your drinking is getting in the way of your work, you know? And they were right. Work had to go. I'm a real alcoholic. I don't stop for the work thing. I don't stop for all that stuff. You know, the type of alcoholic I am, and I shared, you know, I had some other stuff too. And by the way, you know, in case you're here, I'm not going to, you know, I'm a big believer in the traditions. I get to spend a lot of time in that, doing that deal. And alcohol shouldn't even do cocaine because we do it alcoholically. And that's a bad deal, you know. And there I am for the fourth or fifth time at the ATM, and it's 5 o'clock in the morning, and they should have special ATMs for guys like me, you know, with the breathalyzer or the place where, you know, it'll, you know, drop you. Because, you know, I'm there for the fourth or fifth time, and if it was telling me the truth, you know, the receipt would come out and say, "No, stupid, you haven't had any money for the last four trips. Zero balance. Don't come back. You know, put some more money in first." You know, I mean, I'm the real deal, you know. And I remember I'd go back and forth, and I'd go to a couple of rehabs, and the future ex is going back and forth with me, you know. And one time she says, "Have you relapsed? Because your behaviors are changing." And my behaviors had started to change because I relapsed. And I said no, because I knew if I said yes, I'm out of the house, right? Like, even the razor-sharp mind of an alcoholic, I knew that. And no, I haven't. She said, "Well, then you need to go see a psychiatrist." I've been seeing a psychiatrist because of me, you know. I'm making her sick, right? You know, in the family disease of alcoholism, the well person tries to help the sick person. And in the family illness of alcoholism, the well person gets sick before the sick person gets well. You know, I'm making her crazy. She's seeing a psychiatrist because I can't stop drinking. You know, and she says, "Well, then you have to go." And I go and I start doing, you know, all kinds of stuff. She says, the psychiatrist says, "You know, your wife thinks that you've relapsed." And I said, "Oh, no, that hasn't happened," because I know I'm out of the house. And she says, "Well, then I'd like you to take these psychological profile tests and start taking all these tests and spend a couple hours there and doing all that." And at the end of that, she says she wants to prescribe some psychotropic drug for me or some whatever, something. And then she says, "And, you know, if you you know, if you have a relapse, you need this and whatnot. And the interesting thing, and we spend a couple hours talking about my inner child and whatnot, and when I go in there, I'm just an alcoholic doing what an alcoholic does, finding the ways and means to get the next drink, right, to get by, you know, doing what we do, what we need to do, what untreated alcoholism requires that we do. And that's how I go in there, just me. By the time I leave there with an inner child. The first thing I do is go get drunk with him. You know, I could have been arrested first. You know, corrupting the morals of minors. As a matter of fact, I probably shouldn't tell. Well, in the interest of 10-step honesty, I actually took my inner child and smoked crack with him. We're not probably not supposed to do that, you know. And the book talks about that. Why can't those people help us? Not being honest with them. I won't give them a fair shake, right? And they can't help me. You know, she goes back and forth with me. And finally, you know, after a year and a half, I go to a rehab. And I don't get back in the house. She won't let me back. And I wind up in an Oxford house. I don't think they have them down here. But they're kind of funny places. Inmates run the asylum. You know, there's no counselors or anything. But the thing is, I got sober there. And I got sober for about a year. And then at the end of a year, I had a little relapse. And I didn't tell anybody because I was starting to talk to I was separated from her. I was starting to date her again, and you know, my family, you know, and sisters and brother, and my mother, you know, my friends, getting people back in my life. So I didn't tell anybody, and I got a job, and I knew I was going to be, you know, tested for the job and everything. So I stopped my little relapse and short relapse. And then what I did is I moved back into the house, and I went to a lot of meetings. And I did what I heard. I, you know, don't drink and go to meetings. And that's what I did. No drinking, no drugging. I went to meetings. I went to a lot of meetings. And I remember at about 3 years sober, you know, I thought I had graduated. I just thought I had graduated. You know, if you had put me on a lie detector and asked me if I was ever going to drink again, I would have said no and the needle wouldn't have moved. I didn't know how that would happen, but I didn't believe I would ever go out again. It took me about 2 more years to start the graduation party. But I did. So I had a year, go out for a short period of time, a couple months, back in, 5 years, and I went out. And I remember what happened. I was going through a takeover at work, and I knew it was going to cost me a lot of money, and I was really pissed off about it. Later, when I was doing my 4-step, my sponsor would tell me that's a resentment. And I was just irate about it. And I would go home and bitch and moan, you know, to the future ex about it. I'd stop going to meetings. I had no sponsor, no support groups. You know, nobody to talk to, and I'm talking to her. And every night I go home and whine about it. And then selfish, self-centered girl that she was, she went and had a heart attack on me. Oh, I'm going through a takeover at work that's going to cost me money. You know, selfish bitch. And I went to visit her that night in the hospital. And she was going to have heart surgery the next day. So tonight, at the time when she needed me more than she had ever needed me in her entire life, and I've been sober for the last 5 years, I asked myself a question. The question was, would it be okay to go out for just a couple nights? I need some relief. I need some emotional relief. Who's going to know? There's no sponsor. Work doesn't expect me. She's having heart surgery tomorrow. I've kind of disappeared from my friends. What's the difference? Now, I live my life forward, but I understand it backward, especially spiritually. And today I know that was the wrong question. The right question would have been, are you willing to lose everyone and everything? Because I made the decision to go out for 2 nights. I didn't go out for 2 nights or 2 weeks or 2 months. That last relapse started in 99 and ended in June of 2001. You know, my last sobriety day. You know, doing the best I could with untreated alcoholism. I had no idea. You know, I was going to bring my intellect to bear on that and just stop when I was ready to stop. You know, bringing my intellect to bear on alcoholism is like bringing a knife to a gunfight. You know, that is just not powerful. It's an insufficient power. You know, and so I wound up down here, and that's just, you know, the alcoholism, the loneliness and terror, the alcoholism. It's just a horrible illness. You know, just where we go, and you know, I go from, you know, the optimist who's sometimes wrong to the pessimist who's always right. And a pessimist who's always right is a man without hope. And hope is the sense of a better future self. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous is a culture of rising spiritual expectations. We come in here, we see people further down the path, and they tell us that if we do what they did, we can get further down the path. And it is that hope of that rising spiritual expectation that in so many instances gives us the momentum to keep moving forward. And when we're untreated and we don't come in here, we don't have that. And that's a dark place to be. You know, what starts out making me funnier, faster, taller, smarter in the absolute life of the party ends up with me sitting in a dark corner of a dark room with the blinds drawn, occasionally peering out for the IBI, the invisible Bureau of Investigation. There's nobody there, Tom. There's no SWAT teams. There's no cameras in the trees. You know. The four horsemen, terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair. You know, that's the bad news, you know. If you're new in AA, you know, look around. You know, these people didn't look like this when they got here. You know, their hair's washed and they're showered and they're clean and, you know, they've been here for a few minutes, you know, getting the teeth back and all this stuff, you know. And, they didn't look like that. These are a bunch of dead people walking, you know. So, you know, the good news is for you, if you're new, we have a way out. The bad news is that when you take that look around, you're looking at all your new best friends. You know, that's just how that goes. You know, we're here. We're available. We're free. Get to know us. It'll be easier if you like us. You know? And, so I come down here. And I come down here, you know, a little over a dozen years ago. And I'm living in one of the local fraction resorts, not too far from here. And at 6 months, I have what I consider my first spiritual awakening. And I had a roommate, and he had the same deal as me. And he had been sober 9 years and gone back out. And I said, I got to talk to him. He said, okay. I said, you know, my obsession has lifted. I've put together a bunch of time before. I can't help feeling that I'm about to do it again. But if I don't change, what would stop me, whether it's 5 years or 15 years, when it hits the fan, from going out and doing the same thing all over again? If I don't change, how could it be otherwise? You know, if I want to know what my life's going to be like next year and I'm unwilling to change, all I got to do is look at last year. If I want to know what I'm going to be thinking about in 6 months and I'm unwilling to change, all I got to do is look at what I was thinking about 6 months ago. My history is my destiny, and how could it be otherwise unless I'm willing to change, right? And that's a rough place for an alcoholic. You know, when I get here, the thing I hate most is my life. I can't stand my life anymore. Oh, no, there's one thing I hate more than my life. It's change. Yeah, one thing. That's a rough deal. I hate my life more than anything. Oh, except for change. I just don't want to change, you know. That's a rough deal. And I'm not the only one who gets here like that, you know. So I have this awakening. I said, I got to find out what's going on. He agreed with that. I had met a guy 6 months earlier when I first got down here. And he had a peace and a serenity and a joy that I had never seen in a man before. And I asked him for help, and he asked me two questions. It was a Sunday morning after a meeting. He said, are you willing to go to any lengths to stay sober, and can you follow a few simple directions? And I said, yes. And he said, have you ever tried this before? And I got on my high horse, self-will run riot, you know. And I said, oh, yeah, hundreds of meetings, sober for years. I said, yeah, the only three things I didn't do were get a sponsor, take the steps, and get this higher power thing. And he just gave me the little Cocker Spaniel, like, that, you know, and, you know, tilted his head and said, oh, so you were a visitor. And that was my first resentment for my new sponsor. But he was right. That was the truth. I had been a visitor. You know, it's only my opinion. It's certainly not in the big book, but it's also my experience. You know, the punishment of the thief, his goods are never safe. The punishment of the liar, he can't believe anyone. The punishment of the adulterer is he can't trust his partner. The punishment of the adulterer, the punishment of the selfish and self-centered, is that he can never fully give nor receive unconditional love. Unconditional love. That's what I had said. I had talked for 33 minutes. That's all I said right there about unconditional love. And that's what those two guys heard. We just never know where that stuff is going to land, right? And I said to my sponsor, I couldn't even remember when I was talking to those two guys what the hell they were talking about. That's what they were talking about. The punishment of the selfish and self-centered is that he can never fully give nor receive unconditional love. I said to my sponsor, I said, I have a confession to make. He said, what are you talking about? I said, I'm afraid. What are you talking about? I'm afraid this thing can't work for me. No, what are you talking about? This is available to all of us. I said, no, you don't understand. I don't believe in God. I'm afraid this thing can't work for me. I've been to a meeting every day for the last 6 months. And everybody that has what I want, that has this peace and this joy and this serenity about them, they only talk about two things. They talk about a spiritual program and a higher power. And I don't believe in God. And I'm afraid this thing is not available to me. Thank God he was sober about 22 years at the time. And he second-stepped me, right? He said, are you willing to believe? And I was so damn desperate at the time that I said yes. He said, that's all it's going to take. That's all it's going to take for us to get started. And the feeling that I had was that he had put his arm around my shoulder. We were going to take a little walk. It was going to take about 12 steps. And he would be with me every step of the way. And he was. You know, and he asked me to read some stuff, reading the big book. And that was important because I needed to get some information. And the information I needed was the information in the doctor's opinion, not the obsession of the mind and the allergy of the body. And that was real important. And the allergy of the body, we don't get that concerned with that in here. You know, if you go to rehab, you go to detox and rehab, that's about getting stopped. AA has nothing to do with getting stopped. AA is about staying stopped. Very, very different. So it deals with the mind. In the book, in the big book, it says, therefore, the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind. You know, the best expression of that, you know, I read a lot of stuff outside of AA, listen to a lot of stuff outside of AA. The best expression I ever heard of that was actually the South African activist, Stephen Biko. And what he said is, the most powerful tool in the hands of the oppressor is the mind of the oppressed. Everything I hear and you read out there, I bring in here. The most powerful tool in the hands of my alcoholism is my alcoholic mind. That's what needs to be changed. I need a brain washing. You know, I need to be changed. So I get that information about that. And once I get that information about that, you know, the first step says we learn that we had to, you know, every step, we have them on the wall shades, but every step has the directions, the narrative is in the big book. And it's on the first page of More About Alcoholism. It says, we learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholic. I know that's the first step. The next line says, this is the first step in recovery, right? But there's something more. I'm an alcoholic who admits I'm powerless and I go out and I relapse. I work with lots of guys, they admit they're powerless and they go out and they relapse. So there's something more going on with the first step, and what is that? That's the next line. The delusion that we are like others or presently maybe has to be smashed. I don't think that's what he's saying two pages later. If I'm confused about the big book, just keep reading, because if it's the truth, Bill will say it again and again. Two pages later, he'll say there must be no lurking notion or reservation of any kind, right? So the gift of the first step is actually that I accept without reservation that I can never safely drink again, and that's the firm foundation upon which all the other steps are built, and without which it's a house of cards, right? So I get that. And my experience is enough to validate the evidence of my alcoholism, right? And that's what we do. You know, that's what our stories are, or what we used to be like. You know, what we talk about in AA is what works. We don't talk about theology or philosophy or religion. We don't talk about that stuff. What we talk about is experience. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. What we used to be like, my life didn't work. What happened, I did the work, took the 12 steps to a spiritual awakening, and as it suggests in here, a personal relationship with God of my understanding, right? And then what my life is like now, it works. That's all we talk about in here, what works and what doesn't. So we get to that second step, and he knows I'm struggling with that. And, you know, 164 pages, 11 chapters, and 12 steps, and what does it say? Let go, let God. That seems like a lot of writing to say let go, let God, doesn't it? But that's what it says. And then one chapter written to a guy like me, the unbeliever, chapter 4, we agnostics. And what does it say? I heard somebody say, get over it. That's fine. But it's written to a guy like me. So it's written specifically for a guy like me. And it says, we had to ask ourselves but one short question. Do I now believe, or am I even willing to believe, that a power greater than myself can solve my problem? And it says, that can be the cornerstone upon which a wonderfully effective spiritual structure can be built. So what it says is, Be willing to be a former agnostic. Be willing to change. Be willing to get over it. Be willing to be open and look at that. And that was important. You know, that's a fun chapter. You know, right in the beginning of the chapter, you know, it says that half of the original were just like me, atheists or agnostics, half the original 100, about 74. You know, Bill loved exaggeration, hyperbole. But, you know, it says to be doomed to an alcoholic death or to live life on a spiritual basis aren't always easy alternatives to face. Did you hear that? To be doomed to an alcoholic death or to live life on... Do you know how long it takes a normal person or earth person, whatever you want to call them, to make that decision? They say, yeah, I'll take door number two, spiritual life, thanks. That's it. It's done. But for me, that's a rough decision. It's like, you know, well, when you say alcoholic death, like, how bad would that be? You know, how long would that last? And, you know, do I get a couple drinks on the way? Can I make a phone call? You know, the razor sharp mind of an alcoholic. You know, it's like our friends, Russell, the alcoholic accent. When an alcoholic sees, hears, reads, or saw something he doesn't like, he finds it confusing. You know, like, you should write your four step. What do you mean? And I know about that. You know, I remember when, I was drinking in a bar with a buddy. Oh, I don't have to do that, never mind. Oh, what the hell, I started it. And I can do whatever I want. I was told I could do that. But it's like I'm drinking in a bar with a buddy, and I'm having an argument, and we leave the bar, and he's in front of me in a car at a red light, and I'm behind him in my car. And all of a sudden, at the red light, he gets out of his car, comes back, and knocks on my window and says, "Hey, you know that thing we were arguing about? Blah, 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 blah," and he starts it. And I love to argue. I think of myself as a passive, nice guy. People like me, I like people, blah, blah, blah. On my fourth step, it was revealed with my sponsor when I'm doing my fifth step. It turns out I'm an intellectual bully. I never met an argument I didn't like. You know, I'd walk into a bar and order a drink, and the next thing is, I'd hear somebody going at it, and I'd be like, "Is this a private argument, or can I even just jump right in?" You know? And I didn't care what it was. It could have been quantum physics or string theory. You know, I don't care how much I know about it. Hey, I was often wrong, but I was rarely in doubt. You know? I was ready to make a good point, you know? And the more I drank, the more the smarter I got, you know? And some of you have heard that. I don't have time to do that, the theory of alcoholic intelligence from the Cheers bar. And the cops, so the cop pulls him over. We sit through two red lights. The cop pulls this guy over, and I pull up behind him. And he starts giving my friend the sobriety test, and I say to the cop, I said, "What's going on?" He says, "Who are you?" I said, "I'm his friend." He said, "Get out of here." And I said, "No, you don't understand." "No, you don't understand. Get out of here." And I said, "No, but he's my friend, and I need to." He said, "Turn around right now, get out of here, and drive away, and you're all right. You say one more word, you're going to jail." I walked about 50 feet, and I said, "I don't think he understands what I'm trying to say." And I walked back, and I said, "You don't understand. He's my friend, and if he needs bail money, he's up against the car." A few minutes later, I'm cuffed in the car. A few minutes later, I'm in a jail cell in the county jail, in the corner, pumping push-ups, playing Charles Bronson's Great Escape, Is that a difficult thing? One more word out of you, I remember when I relapsed, my behaviors changed. I stopped showing up for work, and I was one or two in the office usually. And my boss called me and gave me a couple of warnings, and then he wrote it up, and he said, "You come in late one more time, miss one more day of work, and you're fired." 2 days later, I made the biggest sale of the year for that company. I logged it into the computer, came in the next day at the crack of noon. He's like, "Where were you this morning?" I'm like, "Did you see that sale I made?" He said, "What are you talking about?" I said, "I just made the biggest sale of the year." He said, "We had an arrangement. Come into my office." And he takes out the letter. "You come in late one more time, you can..." He said, go clear out your desk, hand in your laptop. 15 minutes later, I was out of that. That was a career job. That was an awesome job. Paid a lot of money. I could have spent the rest of my life there. I didn't know what he meant. The future ex, when I relapsed in 99, and she saw what was going on, she said, "Your behaviors are changing. Have you relapsed?" "No, no, no, I haven't relapsed." She said, "You relapse one more time, and we're done." Uh-huh. You know what I heard? "When she finds out that I've already relapsed, we're going to be in a really bad fight, and I'm sleeping in the guest room for a little while." You know what she meant? We were done. That was it. We were done. I got my divorce papers walking out of rehab on the way down here, and we'd been together 20 years. Yeah. Spent the first few years grieving the loss of my love and the lateness of my learning. I'm a slow learner. That was a rough deal. That's a rough deal. We close doors. Sometimes those doors can be reopened, and sometimes they can't, So we finished the rest of We Agnostics, and that, like I said, that chapter is written for a guy like me. And at the end of We Agnostics, you know what it really says? That the difference between me and God is that he does not suffer the delusion that he is me. He is so clear about not wanting to play the actor Tom, And I need to get straight about that. And I take the second step on the backs of the AAs that have gone before me that said that they were willing to believe, they had been former unbelievers themselves, and it had worked for them. And I get to the third step. And the third step in the big book, we always talk about the prayer, but the prayer, the third step is actually right before that. It's on the page before that. And it says we had to quit playing God. Why? Because it didn't work. So all we talk about is what works and what doesn't work. And it says, next, we decided that hereafter in the drama of life, God would be the director. That he would be the principal and we'd be the agents. He's the father and we're the children. And says most good ideas are simple. And this concept was the keystone of the new and triumphant arch through which we'd pass to freedom. The decision of the third step is to make God the director in my life. Right after that come the promises. And how do the promises of the third step start? On top of 63. When we sincerely took such a position, all types of remarkable things happened. Well, I've taken a position. What would be that position? The position of the actor to the director. The position of the agent to the principal. The position of the child to the father. A position of obedience. That I need, I come in here in a state of rebellion, resistance, defiance, and denial. And somehow I got to get to a place of surrender, acceptance, belief, and obedience. First three steps. By God's grace. Unearned, unwarranted. I just need to be willing to get into it. And we get down on our knees and we say the third step prayer and he holds my hand. And we get up and he gives me a hug and I feel different. I just feel different. And I don't know what, it's like the feeling of deja vu, of never having been there before. And I have a feeling that whatever force is going to direct my life is going to do a better job than I've done so far. And probably my strong belief in my sponsor is serving me better than my weak belief in my higher power. But that's coming because he's going to continue to hold my hand through the steps until he can get it into God's hand. And at the end of the third step, he asked me to make a commitment. And the commitment that he asked me to make was that I take the rest of the steps with him. And he said the reason that it was so important for me to take the rest of the steps and have a spiritual awakening, because after that, I would be free to go anywhere and do anything. But if I didn't do that, if I didn't make that commitment and keep that commitment and take these 12 steps, then I would probably drink again. And then instead of going out there and carrying the message, I would spread the disease. And the disease that I would spread would be that AA doesn't work, and the truth would be that I never did the work. And you know what? It's for the skeptic, no explanation is sufficient. I didn't want to hear about the God thing. And today, for the believer, no explanation is necessary. I've got 180 degrees on that. I've long since left that behind, that childish thinking behind. But it was where I needed to start. And the gateway is wide enough and open enough in the steps for me to do that. I know I need to wind this up here. If you're new and you're thinking that... it's not me, it's them, It's like when I first did a four-step, I thought that I was a list of crimes and misdemeanors against me. I'm here through bad breaks and misunderstandings, and if the bastards would only behave, my life would be perfect. And we got to move across that inventory sheet from thinking about who they are and what they did to me to who he is and what he's doing for me. That's what that transition is, about turning our will and our life over, about no longer having a way. If I don't have a way, I really can't be upset because things are never not going my way. This is about giving up the way, right? About realizing that I'm the bad news is in 4 and 5 that I find out that I'm the problem, right? The good news is that in 6 and 7, I don't get to take your stuff to my God. Thank God it's me. Thank God it's me. And today I can even say thank God for my shortcomings without which I have no need to draw close to him. But if you're new and you're thinking that it's still everybody else, we have a sister fellowship. It's called Al-Anon, right? They have a first step. You know what their first step is? We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Wow. That sounds kind of familiar, doesn't it? That's a lot like ours. No, we have a third tradition, too. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. And don't let anybody scare you away from the podium. There's no second requirement. There's no belief requirement here. There's one requirement to stop drinking, and the long form suffer from alcoholism, the long form of third tradition. Now, I know that there's some guys sitting in the back, in the aisle of denial up against the wall of shame. I know. And they're sitting there saying, yes, no second requirement, no belief requirement. And I know that you believe that you understood what you think I just said. But I'm not sure you realize that what you heard was not what I meant. Because nowhere in Alcoholics Anonymous or AA literature does it suggest that I can help a guy get stopped and stay stopped without God. We just don't have that program here. We just don't have that. So if you're new and you're thinking that it's not you and it's them, try wrapping your head around their third tradition. You know what their third tradition is? The only requirement for membership is that there be a problem of alcohol in a relative or a friend. Did you hear that? The only requirement for membership is that there be a problem of alcohol, a relative or a friend. You know what that means? That means that there are thousands of meetings going around this country today and tens of thousands of people attending them. And do you know what the problem is? They know one of us. They married one of us. They go out with one of us. They work with one of us. They rubbed up against one of us in the express line at the supermarket. Their whole problem is us. So if you're new and you're thinking that it's not me, it's them, try wrapping your head and your heart around that. God bless you.
Did you guys enjoy that?
Yes.
That's what we call in New York a sleeper. He's been walking around here for a couple years.